Hey, good morning, everyone. This is Bobby from Bobby on Fire. And today, through Zoom, we have my friends John.
Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, John. And Anne is also on.
Hello, Bobby. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, everyone. Today, I had a topic that came up in my mind because this about 3 days ago was the 30th. I guess it was the 30th anniversary of a major incident. A wildfire happened in Arizona. Six firefighters were killed. I've mentioned this incident several times. But 30 years ago, six firefighters were killed trying to protect a subdivision in Arizona. And it seems like every summer, firefighters are killed every summer trying to protect homes from wildfires. And so I thought, well, this would be a good topic to talk about what individuals can do to protect their homes from burning down from a wildfire, and what they should insist that their elected officials do to help protect the subdivisions. So I want to talk a little bit. That's the reason I'm telling this story today, is just because it lines up with this anniversary. But let me tell you a couple stories about trying to protect subdivisions. So I was on the fire where the six firefighters were killed 30 years ago, and played a part in all that. But I have been on so many fires doing structure protection, we call it. The wildland firefighters call, on a wildland fire, we call it structure protection. When you're assigned to protecting a subdivision or some homes. And I've been on tons of assignments doing structure protection. Well, I've had some successes and I've had some less than successes. But let me tell you one of the things that really kind of got me going one time. I was on a fire, and the fire was in the wilderness area. It was in California, and the fire had been, a couple miles from these homes for several weeks, and we had been actively fighting the fire. But it was very steep, very rugged, it was dangerous, and the fire would blow past the lines, and the subdivision had been in a level one evacuation order, meaning don't need to evacuate, but you got to know there's a possibility you may have to. So prepare, what you need to do to prepare. Level two would be, it's kind of like ready, set, go. Level two is, you better get ready. There's a chance that you're going to be called upon to evacuate right away, so be ready. And then three is go. Three is got to get out now. So these folks had been in level one for quite a while, and then some things happened on the fire, and then went into level two. Now, I had been driving past these homes every day on the way to check on the work of the firefighters, and they were in level one or two. Now, so you're in an area that's prone to wildland fires. You're in some nice houses. It's in a very, kind of an affluent area. And you know that the fire is just on the other side of the ridge from you, maybe a mile or two away. And for a week or 10 days, the homeowners in that subdivision were doing nothing to prepare in case the fire came over the ridge. Well, one night, the fire came over the ridge. I get a call about 5 in the morning. The night crews and the night resources that were on the fire called on the radio. So now I'm running fast to get up to that subdivision to see what's going on. So those folks that lived in that subdivision had been in a level one and then a level two for, like I said, 10 days. They had done nothing to prepare for this. Now that they were told to evacuate because the fire had come over the ridge and was working its way down to the houses, as I'm driving up to see what my firefighters are doing, there's people on the roofs of their homes raking the pine needles off the roof and raking the pine needles away from the home so that the fire wouldn't spread across the ground and ignite their house. Now, they had 10 days to prepare. They should do it every spring. Everybody, every spring, should prepare your home if you live anywhere where there's a risk from wildfire. These people not only didn't do it in the spring, they didn't do it when they were in a level 1 evacuation. They didn't do it in a level 2 evacuation. At level 3, when they're told to evacuate, that's when they ladder their roof and start scraping and sweeping the pine needles off their roof. Now, I was so appalled at when I saw that. I lost all sense of objectivity on the subject, because I think it was the year before, just a year before, down in Southern California, 5 Forest Service firefighters were killed that were working on an engine that were protecting some homes on a large wildfire in Southern Cal. And this was the following summer. And I thought people just had so little disregard for, they had so little regard for the firefighters that they wouldn't even consider taking this some action. When it was just the summer before, where young firefighters were killed protecting some homes. So that's kind of some of what I have seen. Now, on the plus side, there's a national program called FireWise. FireWise, and if you go to firewise.org, it'll take you to a website that shows you how to prepare your home, what kind of building materials to use, how to landscape appropriately with the right plants. There's all sorts of things you can do. And if you live in a remote subdivision where there's been lots of those built over the last 30 years, where you're out in the woods, you're out in the brush, you're out in the wildland, and whether it's East Coast, whether it's the middle of the country or the West Coast, if you're surrounded by natural vegetation, you are at risk from a wildfire. Now, they might not be real common where you live, but I guarantee you everywhere these days can burn because of the warming and drying seasons that we're having. So FireWise can help you understand what you need to do. It doesn't mean cutting all the trees down around your house and paving everything. It means that maybe you thin some of the trees so the trees aren't right next to each other and you have space between them. It means that you rake up your pine needles or your leaves so you don't have those blown around. I have been on fires where the main fire went through a subdivision and you saved the house. You saved the houses. But you have to keep on going to keep protecting the next houses that are going to be in the path of the flaming front. Unfortunately, what happens is when you've turned your back, the fire that you thought you were had left and it was safe, it starts to creep. Now it's not flaming around, but most of the houses that burn up actually burn after the flaming front has gone by, and the fire starts creeping on the pine needles and the ground covers and the mulch, and that little creeping, smoldering fire starts the wood fence on fire, it starts the wood pile on fire, or it starts the wood deck on fire, and the house burns down. It's fascinating that so many of the fires of the houses that have burned down were not burned down from the flaming front that comes through. It's that afterwards where the fire is creeping around. There's lots of things you can do. Now, you see in the news like whole subdivisions burned down that aren't even near the wildland. But maybe the houses on the edge of the subdivision were impacted by the wildland fire coming in towards the subdivision, and those houses start on fire, and then that starts the houses next to them. The embers start blowing, the wind is blowing, so the embers start blowing from one house to the next to the next, and entire subdivisions have burned down this way. Now, it seems like this is new, but really, this has been going on for 100 and some years. The fires start in the wildland, but then spread into the city or into the town, and we have large conflagrations and thousands of homes burned down. So you have some ability, you have personal responsibility to protect your home. You know, you don't purposely leave a frayed extension cord plugged in your house, because you can call the fire department, but the point is that frayed extension cord, it's easy to say, look and say, oh, I better get rid of that frayed extension cord. You don't say, well, the fire department will show up and save my house. No, you take some responsibility and you get rid of that frayed extension cord. You don't leave grease in a frying pan on purpose on your stove, saying, well, if it starts on fire, the fire department will show up. No, you take care of it. It's the same way when we're talking about wildland fire and protecting your homes. You shouldn't be relying on the fire department to come, because in the wildland situation, there are hundreds and hundreds and possibly thousands of homes at risk at the same time that you need help. So you need to take some personal responsibility. That means maintenance. That means things like making sure the eaves up above, where the roof and the wall come together, make sure those eaves are sealed off. Now, you want to have vents, but the vents should have screens on them so that the air can flow through, but the embers cannot. All these little nooks and crannies on a wood frame house where embers can fly up and sit or get up into the attic, that's how the fire starts. Or get up under the wood shake shingles. That's like putting kindling on your house and sprinkling gasoline on it. You have personal choices you can make. Now, what about in a bigger picture? In the bigger picture, cities and towns and counties can have ordinances. Now, what kind of an ordinance is going to make a difference about whether your house survives a wildland fire or not? One of the first things a fire department needs is access. And access doesn't mean a little two-track dirt trail that goes around from house to house. It means having a wide road where multiple vehicles can pass at the same time. Imagine there's a fire starts. Say your neighbor is burning trash, or maybe, which is illegal, or burning weeds, or maybe they have a little chimney fire that spreads, or something that isn't their fault at all, but a fire starts in the house and it starts the wildland on fire. Now you have everybody living in this subdivision trying to get out, and all at the same time the fire engines are trying to come in. If the roads are too narrow, you have a bottleneck of people trying to get out with the apparatus trying to get in. These new modern fire engines are like 10 feet wide. I mean, they take up a whole road if it's just a narrow little road. So what can the county, the politicians, the city councils, what can they do? They can make sure that new subdivisions have wide roads, wide enough so multiple vehicles can pass. They can make sure that these roads are not too steep. I have seen subdivisions that were put in and approved by the county that have very, very steep roads and narrow, and they're completely covered over with trees and brush. That makes it impossible. So I have worked in places when there was new subdivisions went in that amongst the fire professionals in the area, we would say that, look at the area and say, well, we can't say this out loud because we'd get fired, but there's no way in hell we're going to go in there if there's a ripping fire, because we can never guarantee we could get out. Roads are too steep, they're too narrow, and there's no turnarounds at the end. So we need big cul-de-sacs at the end of a dead-end road. We need a wide cul-de-sac so that the fire engine can turn around and get out. You can't expect this fire engine to back all the way back the way it came. There's got to be turnarounds for the fire engines. And what else would we need? Well, we need fire hydrants. We need fire hydrants with a water supply. So you would think, well, why? Who would be against building a subdivision with a water supply, with wide roads, and all that sort of thing? Well, who's against it is the developer. The developer is investing their money to build this subdivision, and the wider the roads, and the more we've eked out for turnarounds, the more money we ask them to spend on a water system, it's costing them money. The realtors are against it, the developers are against it, and the county commissioners or the city council or whoever it is, they're influenced by those folks. I've attended zoning meetings or city council meetings where the entire representation of the county fire chiefs group would be in attendance to say, please pass this resolution to allow for new subdivisions to have wider roads, turnarounds, water supplies. Here's the people who are going to be protecting their homes, your homes, and the city council does not approve it, and they follow the advice of the developers, and we don't get the, so then we have another subdivision that's unsafe. So this is how my jaded, cynical view of this works. So, people have an absolute ability to protect their home, make it safe, by trimming the trees, by landscaping appropriately, by having the right building materials. The politicians have the ability to influence these results because they can make sure that new roads or new subdivisions going in, they have some zoning requirements, water supplies, road width. In certain states, they have banned shake shingle roofs. So that the shake shingle roofs are no longer built on new homes and can't be put on old homes. So that's two things. You got the individual landowner or the homeowner, and then the politicians. And if those things fail, if the homeowner hasn't done their share and the politician hasn't done their share, who's it left to? It's left to the firefighters that show up on the engine. Now, the wildland firefighters are oftentimes young, seasonal. They're not even full-time. Most of them are not even full-time firefighters. They're what used to be college students, but the season's gotten so much longer now. They're seasonal employees. They might work 4 to 6 months, maybe 9 months. These are young people who we're putting at risk because you as a homeowner were unwilling to do your job and the politicians were unwilling to do their job. And so who does it fall to? It falls to the 22-year-old kid working on the engine, shows up and has to try to protect the homes. That may sound stark and not real happy, but it's a bad situation. Firefighters die every year trying to protect homes from a wildfire. Now, you might say, well, firefighting is a dangerous profession. It is, but we don't have to make it worse for these folks who are responding, trying to save your houses. You need to take some personal responsibility. Now, I will reiterate, go to FireWise. That's FireWise. I think it's .org. I'll post it on the write-up on the page. And you can get great information about how to protect your home from wildfire. There is specific information about how far away your flammable material should be from the house, wood piles, wood fences, trees, all the different kinds of plants that can be, that are some better, plants are better than others for being protecting your house. So I would just ask everybody to pay attention to that. This is, we're in the middle of June. The fire season is in full effect down in Arizona in the Southwest right now. Lots of fires, and we're losing important, beautiful desert habitat down there. So I would ask that you guys go to FireWise and read up what can go on there. Anne, do you have any questions or any input?
Well, that was really interesting. Things I hadn't even thought about because I live smack in the middle of the city.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but there's a fire burning right now in Tucson.
Well, there's several burning right around Phoenix right now and Tucson.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and these same principles you learn in FireWise can be applied for your homes in the city, because if your neighbor's house starts on fire, there's very high risk that your house could start on fire. So the same principles apply even in the city. So it's worth it for everybody to take a look at what that is. John?
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry.
One thing that strikes me is that, like, by making your home a bit safer by doing the landscaping and things that you mentioned, you're helping protect your neighbors' homes as well. Because right. If yours goes up in flame, that obviously has a huge impact on the others. Do you ever go into after a fire and see that this house burned, but the house next door didn't burn, or it's scattered, or does it, when it goes to a neighbor, does it knock out all the houses?
No, it's very picky, and houses that we would think, oh, that one's going to burn for sure. That one, you know, that one's going to go down to the ashes. When you come back in after you've been fighting fire and you're driving around and you're trying to prioritize, and you come back and you say, holy crap, that house survived. I can't believe it survived. And the ones that you think were going to survive ended up burning down. So even though we make really sound decisions based on our professional experience, it doesn't always go exactly the way we expect. There was a fire in Washington a few years ago that burned through this valley. There were homes, now this is a great illustration. There were homes surrounded by alfalfa fields, green irrigated alfalfa fields, and some of the homes in the middle of those alfalfa fields burned down. Now, why would the fire burning on the hillsides, why would they burn down the house in the middle of an irrigated alfalfa field? Well, the reason is because there's so many burning embers coming out of the sky. The fire not necessarily burning on the ground, the fire spreading by the embers. And so imagine like snowflakes coming down in a big snowstorm, except those are all burning embers. Well, they're landing on a dried shake shingle roof, or they're landing on the wood pile piled up against the house, or they're landing on the wood deck with flammables stored underneath. And those homes burnt down in the middle of irrigated alfalfa fields because of the embers, not because of... So you can have everything good. You can have a green lawn all around your house. It'll still burn down potentially if you have flammable material exposed to these embers. All right, folks, I'm going to leave it at that. This week's story got no laughs, and it shouldn't get any laughs. So next week we'll make sure it's a more uplifting story. But this week is pretty important with all the fires burning in the southwest part of the country right now, and anniversary of a pretty important fire in my life and other people's lives. I wanted to just emphasize everybody has the ability to help save lives. Okay, folks, thanks very much. We will talk to you next week, and thanks for listening.